You know, Scott, recently I heard someone say, a professional in the psychological field, the only way that we learn and grow is through two avenues. One is fear and the other is pain. I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know if those are the only ways. I think there are probably more ways than that, but I think some of the most important ways I've grown in my life have been through experiencing certain pains, simply in the recognition that we can survive them. You know, when we overcome great struggles in our lives, we learn that we have more resilience and more strength than we might have thought otherwise. And I also think, you know, if we're paying attention to our lives, if we're bringing awareness to the harder moments, we're likely to find gifts in even the greatest struggles. You know, so I agree with that in essence, that some of the greatest growth happens in pain and fear. But I think there's always opportunity to grow.
I hope you're right. But but I suspect that this person probably hit it in great part the nail on the head. It does seem like we just sail happily along when things are all wonderful, but we stop in our tracks and do a lot of introspection. And I guess there's a reason they call it growing pains.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. You know, you're a very positive person. We can see that from this book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. But wide open heart, that takes a lot of vulnerability, that takes a lot of trust in the journey. And yet you've got, and this would kind of go to prove the point of this person, you've got a lot of pain in your background. There was a lot of trauma when you were quite young still, age 14, when you lost your parents. And then there are other things that came up, your brother, for instance. Talk to us a little bit about that, what happened and how that did change you.
Well, my parents were shot to death when I was 14, so that changed everything profoundly. And, you know, I think we can reflect on certain experiences in our lives and, you know, we find the ways in which it's impacted us. And I think that there are certain things I'll never even know the extent to which losing my parents at that age has affected me. I know that one of the gifts that came from that, when I speak about, you know, gifts in pain, is that when you deal with great trauma and you deal with loss and grief and the sadness that comes along with it, I found that it has made me so much more compassionate and so much more available to connecting to others in their pain because of what I've gone through. And though I could never look at losing my parents as a gift, and, you know, I'm not grateful for losing them in any way, I see that I don't think I would be as open-hearted as I am today. I doubt I would be as compassionate as I am today. I doubt I would be willing to meet people in their sadness as I am today because of what I experienced with my parents.
As well as losing your brother.
Yes, I mean, my brother died from a heroin overdose 9 years after my parents died, and losing him was very different. I mean, in part because with my parents, I was 14 and it was an absolute shock for my family. Obviously, we couldn't have guessed that they were going to die, let alone be murdered. With my brother, he had been addicted to heroin his entire adult life, and he was 18 years my senior. Mm. So honestly, there was always a part of me that was expecting that call from one of my family members telling me that Ricky had died. Yeah. There was always a part of me kind of ready for that moment. And it's not that it made it less sad. It made it less shocking. And I think the journey for me with my brother was really a journey of compassion, mm-hmm. and a journey of empathy, because growing up around addiction like that is very difficult. And I grew up with a lot of resentment and a lot of hatred toward my brother. Love too, because he was a very kind person, but he brought a lot of heartache to our family. And so the process of connecting to him was one of moving through the resentment and moving through the judgment and recognizing him as another human being with his own human pains and his own human story. And that I couldn't know everything that was going on for my brother that led him to his addiction. And I couldn't know all the reasons he wasn't able to face his life in a sober way. But I was able, and it didn't happen more so until after his death. I was more capable of viewing him through a lens of compassion and empathy and love. And when I reflect on my brother now, it's only in that way.
And understandably so, since you were so young when you lost your parents, you struggled a lot with just facing up to your grief, being able to experience it fully. You write about that in the book.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was a 14-year-old, I didn't do anything in a conscious way in terms of how I dealt with my parents. I'm so grateful that on a subconscious level, or, you know, a miracle, whatever you want to call it, I knew to bury it. And yeah. It's when I write about this in the chapter called Dig, what I'm recommending to people is the exact opposite of what I did as a 14-year-old, which is to bury it and not face it. And once a year I would have a cry about my parents, and then I'd lock it away again. I felt embarrassed to be an orphan. I felt it was my big secret. It was this thing I didn't want to share with anyone, because if I did, people couldn't handle it. It's one thing to live in suburban Detroit and have your parents dead. It's a completely other thing to have them murdered. And you say this to someone, and it's so overwhelming for them, and their overwhelm would overwhelm me. And it was never a conversation I invited. I worked hard to avoid those conversations. But I learned that in my 20s, I started to see the ways in which I had really closed myself off from the deepest possible connections with people, because I had created this big secret around myself and around my past and my experience. And we can't really be selective with the walls we create. When we're putting up a wall to our darkness, we're also putting up a wall to the greatest potential for light. You know, it's all energy as far as I see. So once I started in my 20s to recognize the limitations I had created in my life by creating the secret around my parents, I started to allow for grief in a different way, which really just meant I allowed myself to cry and feel and rage. And once I started to do that, once I started to sit in the pain, it also, I felt, made me more available to deeper connections with people, more honest connections with people. And I think, Zinta, that we're so afraid in our country and everywhere, but I think in our country, which is, it's such an addicted society, mm-hmm. we're so afraid to just be present in our pain. So we're numbing and we're escaping constantly. We're putting so much energy into running away from uncomfortable feelings. Yeah. And it's only when we sit in them do we see that we can actually survive them, that we're okay, you know? And once I started doing that, I was able to see something that I think I feared, which is that I can survive talking about the grief with my parents. I can survive crying. I can survive raging about it. Mm-hmm. This is the human experience, you know, and it's okay, and I'm okay within it.
I absolutely agree with you. I think going through grief, not around it, not above or below it, but right through it, walking through that fire builds emotional muscle, builds resilience. Yes. And as you've said, it also builds empathy for others who are going through some kind of grief of their own.
Absolutely.
And yet, at some point, you wrote in the book that you were able to forgive the person who took the lives of your parents.
Yes. And I mean, you just said the word empathy, and that was really my path to forgiveness of the man who killed my parents. I mean, again, in my teenage years, that wasn't anything I was thinking about. If I thought about their killer, it was with rage and vengeful thoughts and, you know, all the things you might expect someone to feel about the man who killed their parents. But again, as I was opening up more in my 20s, and as I was connecting more to the power of love in my life and the importance of the energy of love in my life, I was also becoming more aware of how those hateful thoughts were affecting me. Mm. You know, we all know what it's like to live in blame and hatred of people when we're stuck in that place where we feel like what they've done is unforgivable. It takes a toll. It takes a toll physically. It takes a toll emotionally. And I didn't know how I would find my way there, but I started to open up to the possibility of forgiveness. And then what I started to do was just to consider this man's humanity, to recognize that no human being who's operating from any place of self-worth or self-love or feeling seen in this world would ever murder other people. It just doesn't happen. And I couldn't connect to killing other people, but I've been so enraged by things people have done that I've wished they would die. And I felt so unloved in my life and so unworthy in my life. I felt all those things that I imagine this man and all human beings feel at certain points in their lives. And so once I started to really see that, you know, he and I aren't really that different. You know, he made a horrible choice and did a terrible thing, but he's still a human being worthy of love and worthy of forgiveness. And it wasn't that I even chose forgiveness, but what I noticed was that by choosing empathy and choosing to connect to his humanity, I started to see that when I would think about him, it was with forgiveness in my heart. So it was almost like forgiveness chose me eventually, because I was committed to finding empathy and compassion for this man.
That phrase comes to mind, only hurt people hurt people.
Yes, it's so true. And I think the same thing that the Buddha said, if you really love yourself, you could never hurt another. And I really believe that.
So then you write this book, and in it you talk about all of these dark moments in your life and how you become you use this term of love spreader, how you transform it into big love and keeping your heart open. Talk about what this book meant to you and what you want it to convey to your readers.
First and foremost, with big love, I believe in the power of love. And when I speak of love, I'm speaking about what I see as the purest energy that informs all the positive things in our world, like kindness and compassion and forgiveness. I think all of those things are love in action. So what I'm really encouraging people all the time and myself to do all the time is just to consider love as the guiding force in your life, to ask yourself the question over and over and over throughout the day, you know, what does love invite me to do in this moment? And to see when you're asking that question and answering it and following up with actions that reflect love, just see how that changes your life. I found that it changes my life profoundly, and what I have to offer myself and my loved ones and this world is so much more positive and powerful when I'm rooted in love. So that's one of the big messages with the book. I also really hope the book helps people feel less alone in their lives and in their struggle. You know, my intention was to be really honest with who I am and to share my insecurities and my fears as well as my joys. And there are some chapters that are very heavy, you know, about my parents and my brother. And there are many chapters that are just focused on everyday things. You know, when we're out in the world engaging with people, we're getting provoked all the time. You know, we're being pushed to question things about ourselves and our reactions all the time. And I think it's really easy also in this world. It can feel very dark and very violent. It is very violent. And it can be very easy when we're struggling to feel isolated and alone and like no one can relate to what we're going through. And my hope with this book and the work that I'm doing in general is just to remind people you are not alone in your struggle, and that you may not know my grief, but you know grief. I may not know yours, but I know my own. And we can connect with each other from these places as human beings, you know, working hard to make sense of this unpredictable reality. You know, and I also tried to bring a lot of humor to the book too, because I feel like humor has helped me so much, you know, being able to laugh at my journey, at the absurdities in life in general, not to take myself so seriously, even though I take myself very seriously also, but also to remember we're a speck of dust in this whole story, you know, and it's okay to approach this experience with lightness and humor as well.
Another lesson that you wrote about in one of the chapters in Big Love that I thought was really relevant in our culture in this country, where fat shaming is still a very pervasive problem. And it was about the middle seat on a flight.
Yeah, I mean, several years ago, I was on a flight and I was in the window seat and there was a man in the aisle seat and the window seat was open. And, you know, I think we all know the joy of thinking that we're going to have an empty seat next to us on an airplane, because they're not particularly comfortable for people of any size. And at the very last minute, a man came who was very large. He was over 6 feet tall, and I'm guessing over 300 pounds, a very heavy man. And he ended up sitting next to me. I watched the way the judgments in my mind played out around him, around his size. I mean, at first it was frustration that he was going to be in the seat, and then the frustration that he was such a big person going to be in the seat, and I was already uncomfortable, and it was all very self-absorbed in my discomfort on the flight, not giving much time to the reality that this poor man had to literally shove himself into the seat to fit it in, and how uncomfortable must he have been. But it led me to reflect on all the prejudices that so many of us have about fat people, and how that seems to be an accepted thing in our country. Yeah. to view fat people as lazy and unhealthy, and all of these judgments that we grow up with, this conditioning that fat is wrong. And because we're taught to believe being fat is wrong, we're taught to see fat people as wrong and making wrong choices. And how, for me, that's so wrong. And that you know, we're making progress in so many different areas around respect for people. You know, we're making progress. Mm-hmm. We still have a long way to go. But it seems to be with people who are obese, it's okay to judge them and to put them down. And this experience I had with this man, we ended up, you know, having a really nice flight and talking a lot together. But at the very, like, as we were descending and I was kind of falling asleep against the window, he said out of the blue, "You know, I know nobody likes to sit next to fat people on airplanes. I don't like to be this fat either." Mm. And it was like this knife to my gut, because what I felt in the moment, and I can't be positive, but I felt that I had done something during that flight to suggest I wasn't comfortable with his size. And I try to be very conscious about how I'm showing up in the world and very respectful. And yeah. But I suspect when he first arrived, maybe I did something, maybe I looked some way, maybe I was a part of making him feel even more insecure about his weight than he was already feeling. And that sucks. That's not how I want to be living my life. That's not how I want to be showing up for others. I certainly don't want to add to people's shame. And as much as I recognize we can never own a person's response to our words and our actions, you know, if however someone's responding to me is for them to own, and however I respond to someone is for me to own, at the same time, we can always be conscious of how much kindness and compassion and respect we're bringing to all of our engagements with people. And it's ridiculous that we still have this environment, especially in the US, where it's okay to fat shame.
Yeah,
it's not okay in any way, you know, and that chapter I was meant to call attention to it. And I really wanted to use myself as an example of how I've gone there in my life and in my past, and it's not okay.
And then you have a very popular page on Facebook, which perhaps was even the seed for this book. And one of the things that you did on that page is the happiness challenge. And I really like that you said happiness is not a choice, because I'll have to admit here and now, that's one of the things that irritates me when people yeah. say happiness is a choice, just choose to be happy. Perhaps it ties in to what we were talking about earlier about experiencing grief, that we should embrace the entire range of emotions. But I want you to talk about that. What was the happiness challenge?
Yeah, the happiness challenge was about a year and a half ago during the month of February, because it was the shortest month, so I figured we'd all have the best shot of achieving it. I invited people on my Facebook community to choose one thing every day of the month that they would do that would potentially create more happiness in their lives. So I chose to do yoga for an hour every day, knowing that when I do yoga, I tend to feel better about myself. Mm-hmm. The point of the challenge was in part to counter that notion that happiness is a choice. And I used to be somebody who bought into that idea that happiness is a choice. And it's a very popular meme. It's and like you now, when I see it, it makes me cringe a little, because happiness isn't a choice. You know, it's an emotion, and we don't choose our emotions. Our emotions, right. You know, they happen as they happen. If you lose a loved one, no matter what you do in that moment, you're not going to be able to choose happiness out of the sky. That's not how it works.
Right.
But But at the same time, we absolutely can choose the actions we're taking in our lives that tend to lead toward happiness. And the example that I used in the book was, when I play tennis, I tend to be happy because tennis makes me happy in general. Mm-hmm. So I know that if I'm choosing to play tennis, there's a good chance that I'm going to find happiness. But choosing tennis is very different than choosing happiness. Choosing tennis is something I can control in my life. And I think what happens for people, and especially in the self-help metaphysical world, a lot of us believe that we can choose happiness, and we're not happy a lot of the time. So not only are we feeling sad, we're also feeling like failures, like we're spiritually, you know, insufficient.
We talk about fat shaming, but there's almost a shaming of, you're not happy, shame on you.
Shame on you, you're not spiritually sound or something. And that's how,
right,
I felt. I felt like I wasn't as spiritually evolved as I should be because I'm not happy all the time.
Yeah.
Granted, I'll admit I'm not as spiritually as evolved as I could be, but it doesn't have to do with that. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
we feel what we feel. And I think it's, we do a disservice to people by putting that pressure on them to be happy all the time.
Yeah.
That's not why we're here, to be happy all the time.
So as we wind this up, I thought it would be really relevant at this time that people are so politically divided. There's a lot of rage out there. There's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of unhappiness. What's your message of big love in this time? What can bring us back together?
Empathy. In a word, empathy. You know, when it's very easy. I mean, what you're saying is real. We all feel it. We're all feeling afraid and unhappy and scared, you know, enraged by what we're seeing out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I feel like our power lives in how we're choosing to show up. You know, when someone's posting something on Facebook that disgusts or offends or enrages you, are you going to respond to the vitriol with more vitriol of your own? Because if you are, you're only adding fuel to a fire that's already burning out of control. So for me, and believe me, when someone posts something that really upsets me, the impulse, the instinct is to want to respond and be like, you're an idiot, you're whatever it is, you know, that human
mind lash out,
impulse,
yeah,
lash out. But if we can just take 10 seconds to consider what it might be like to walk in that person's shoes, to consider what their struggle in life might be like, all of the things in their life that led them to this point of saying and believing and feeling whatever it is they feel today. I have found that when I allow for that empathy, it is virtually impossible for me to show up with hatred in my heart. And that doesn't mean I'm going to condone what they say or agree with it anyway. It doesn't mean I'm going to stop from sharing what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can take the time to empathize with another person, there's a good chance that when I'm ready to share what I believe, it's going to be with some kindness and with some compassion. And only when we communicate from that place are we going to have a chance of finding common ground. And if not common ground, at least respect. And at least we can start creating real communications with one another. Because if we're just shooting fire at one another, no one's listening to anything that's going on. And we can't find any connection in that way. So I really encourage people. And empathy, we all can be empathetic. And we also can all practice at it. And the more we practice at it, the more we take time to look at the other person's humanity, the more natural it becomes to do. So I'm really hopeful because I know that that's where my power lives. And how am I showing up in the world? What example am I setting? And if I'm declaring myself a person who wants to represent love in the world, then it is incumbent upon me to represent love in the world, you know, and be that example. And we can all be that example.
Well, yours is a wonderful and much needed message right now. Thank you for talking with us, Scott.
Oh, Zinta, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the work you're doing.